thank you for coming. You know, there are a lot of things that you could be doing on a Friday night, and to be here and for us to gather together to look into a subject that we're going to look into, which is basically how to find and project your inner power. And it's an extremely important subject, especially with everything that's going on around us. The dictionary defines power as the ability to control people or things. And I don't know if you read anything on the internet, but it seems to be that that's the tendency, the trend of the hour, especially with the elections going on and all of the turmoil in the world, that there's this enormous energy that goes out in an attempt to control things, people, countries, religions, all kinds of things where that control is spent outward. And if we were able to pull back a little bit and really look, we could see how much of our energy, how much money, how much time, how much of our psychic energy is spent in trying to control the world around us. Enormous amounts of it. I mean, you drive down the street, and if the temperature control on the car isn't exactly right, it's a source of irritation. If the traffic isn't going your way, it's a mild source of irritation. So we're constantly trying to control the world around us. In human relationships, we think that if we can only control our partner or our work environment or the boss or the people around us, that if we can only fix them in a place that we want them to be in, then everything will be okay. We have, and it starts early. We have a granddaughter who's about 5 now. We'll just turn 6 in a couple of weeks. But when she was about 3 or 4, she would kind of walk down and she'd look around and she'd get this smile. Everything's under control. You know, so it's not just that it starts later on when we become an adult. It starts very early. It goes way, way farther than humanity alone. You know, you look at there are basic fundamental needs of life. One is the ability to stay alive. Another is the ability to reproduce. And the third, I'll come back to this because I'm talking here about the chakras also, but I'll come back to that. I want to introduce the concept that these are fundamental principles that are there in life no matter how it's expressed. So the ability to stay alive, the ability to reproduce, and the ability to extend power over your environment, control other organisms or things. If you're an amoeba, you want to have control over the other amoebas and you want to be able to get to the right environment. You want to get to the food sources and you want to gather more into yourself. And I think the really greedy amoebas grow up and become greedy people. You know, that because once we begin to have the expectation that more and more control is going to lead to more and more what? What does it lead to? Why do we want to control in the first place? Obviously, it's part of staying alive. But Yogananda said something very interesting. This was the key concept of the first book that he wrote called Science of Religion. So when he came to America in the very early years, he came in 1920, Within the next 2 or 3 years, he published The Science of Religion. And the key concept in that is that everyone in the world is motivated by exactly the same basic motivation. That motivation is the desire to be happy and to avoid pain. And it isn't just people, it's life is motivated by that. So if you think of that as the evolutionary force for all of life, we think evolution is physical, but it isn't really physical, it's of the consciousness. And so the evolutionary force behind what helps people, things evolve, is the desire to be happy and the desire to avoid pain. And that goes all the way down to those amoebas. They don't cognize it as such, but they're trying to get to conditions that will make life a little better for them. And so we too, you know, no matter where you are on this long scale of evolution, you're after that same paradigm. We're trying to be happy and we're trying to avoid pain. And so the desire to control things outside of ourself is central to that paradigm, that we think that by controlling something or someone or some country or some religion or something outside of ourself, that that is what's going to make us happy. Now, I don't know about your experience, but my experience is, one, I'm not very successful in controlling things outside of myself. Maybe I can control the heat a little bit, but when it gets to people, you don't have much control over people. I mean, look at the dictators of the world. Maybe you can control the outward behavior or the movement of people. Or we just finished reading a very powerful book about the France during the Nazi occupation of France. It's a very well-written book. If you're interested in those kinds of things, it's called The Nightingale. But it brings very, very poignantly what it's like to live in an environment that is largely under the control of somebody who does not have your own interests in mind. Control access to food, access to clothing, all kinds of things. But how long do dictators last? How much change in the world do they actually produce? Not very much. There's a wonderful story that Yogananda talks about Alexander the Great. Now, he's called the Great because he was one of the few people who basically conquered, for him at that time, the known world. So he starts out in Macedonia and conquers Greece and conquers beyond that into Persia and on until he finally comes to India. And after many years, but he's undefeatable. And so nobody can oppose him. So he comes to India, and he's always also had an interest in spirituality. So he goes to find omens and spiritual teachers and so on. So he hears about this spiritual teacher in India. So he sends one of his chief ministers out to this yogi who's sitting under a tree, and the minister for Alexander, the ambassador for Alexander, says, Alexander the Great, the conqueror of the entire world, has sent me to order you to come to him, and he wants to talk with you. And if you come with me, he will offer you great riches. And if you do not come with me, I'm instructed to come cut off your head. And this yogi sitting there under a tree kind of looks up and he says, well, you go tell Alexander that I have no more use for his riches than I have for my head. not exactly the answer I think that Alexander or the minister was expecting. So the minister goes back, and Alexander is very intrigued by this. And so he comes, and he comes to this yogi, and he says, I am Alexander the Great. I am the conqueror of the entire earth. And the yogi looks, and he says, I think my feet are bigger than yours. I cover more of the earth than you do when I stand up. And then Alexander says, well, he's intrigued. He says, what can I do for you? And the yogi says, could you move a little that way? You're blocking the sun. I like the sun on me. And so at any rate, that's the difference between outer control and inner control, outer power and inner power. And so actually, it is a very interesting story. This was a great man, a great yogi, and he actually went with Alexander and his army and traveled back to Greece, where he was known as Kalyanos in India, Kalyana. And at any rate, history has these interesting examples of inner power and outer power. But Alexander, having conquered the entire world at that point, now come back to what Yogananda said is your basic motivation and Alexander's basic motivation. So he has put enormous energy out, enormous willpower, been able to muster armies and defeat everybody in his way. Was he any happier for having accomplished that than if he had not accomplished it? Well, probably in the short term he was, because we have this odd mechanism that goes on. We can be perfectly content. Well, we're not perfectly content because there's always underneath the rumbling energy to be discontent. But imagine for a moment that we're in a period of quiescence and we're content. Well, then, because of past habit patterns, we begin to have a desire. So we become discontent. And that desire is for something. And once the mind fixes on that, we think that if we achieve that, then we will be happy. And that's true for a very short period of time. And, you know, psychologists say that if you get some, I think there's, again, one of those enormous gazillion-dollar lotteries floating around out there. So somebody's going to win that. And somebody, for a very short period of time, that will make them happy because they've defined in their minds that if I have a lot of money, I'll have a lot of power, I'll have a lot of control, and I'll be able to be happy and I'll be able to avoid pain. So that dynamic is going on. And so somebody will be happy, but how long will it last? You've probably read, I've read, that many, many of those lottery winners say a few months or a few years later that the worst thing that ever happened to them in their life was winning that lottery. Partly because it messes up their life. It's too much energy for them to be able to control at their current level of consciousness. And so partly it messes up their life, but almost worse than that, it pops the bubble of that particular delusion, which is more money equals more happiness. And then they have a gazillion dollars and pop that delusion that money is going to make us happy. And they don't have anything to substitute for it because their energy has gone out. But it's with other things. We have a friend, an amusing story. He said that he, for quite a long time, really, really wanted a Porsche. And so he worked hard, he saved up the money, but by this time he was a yogi and he was practicing more of the practices of inner happiness and inner contentment. So finally he gets the Porsche, and the psychologists say that generally when you get something, your happiness lasts for, it goes up and it lasts for about 6 months or so, and then it descends back down to the kind of what Swami called your specific gravity. So your happiness specific gravity is your inner happiness, inner power. And so normally that process is about 6 months. So here's this guy, works really hard, gets his Porsche, and it didn't last 6 months. It went like that. He said by the time he got home and parked in his driveway, he realized the folly of trying to get that Porsche. He realized that that Porsche no longer made him happy, but because he had become a yogi. So we try to project out control over the environment, thinking that control over people or things, which is power, is going to make us happy. And that's the dynamic going on. Now, when you're caught up in a madness like this, it's very, very hard to convince anybody that the particular madness they're caught in is not real. You know, they have to go through that cycle and follow it to the end until they realize that a Porsche or a gazillion dollars or being president is not what they're really after, not what's going to make them happy. And it may be many, many lifetimes that that cycle is there and continues. But coming back to this thought that for a long time in the evolution of our consciousness, because the teachings of India say that we have a consciousness, and it's that consciousness or the soul that inhabits different bodies. So that amoeba and the mosquito and the worm and the tree and the dog, all of those, we go through those movements and of evolution, but it's the same consciousness ultimately that is going through those different vehicles. And so it may take many, many, many lifetimes if you have a really strong fixation on a delusion, since we're talking about power tonight. Let's say that you're fixated, or you have the idea that control of other people or control of a country is what is going to produce happiness for you. I don't know how long it takes a person being fixated on that idea to become president of the United States or to become the conqueror of some territory, but it takes a long time in that fixation, a lot of energy toward it. But ultimately, we and everyone will find that nothing outside of ourselves will fix that fundamental motivation, which is we want to be happy and we want to avoid pain, because happiness and pain do not lie outside of ourselves. They lie within ourselves. And as long as we're caught in that drama of thinking that happiness lies outside of ourselves, we are absolutely destined to fail in what we're really after, which is finding happiness. So happiness lies within. But does power lie within? Because obviously there are thousands and thousands of examples of people who have expressed a great deal of power outward into the world. You know, we look back, and why do we remember Alexander the Great all these millennia after he was there, after he was on the earth, because he was an example of someone who was able to exert enormous control over other people and other things. So we remember him. But how much of our life, how much of present-day life has been changed because of him? How does he affect you or me? Does Alexander's life make you happier as we sit here tonight? I don't think it makes me happier. It might be an incident in history, interesting to read about, fun to talk about, but it doesn't really affect our lives. Who affects our lives from back in that time? Aristotle affects our lives. Christ affects our lives. Buddha affects our lives. Krishna affects our lives because they taught principles and they had inner power and inner control, and those principles have affected not just a few people. You know, Christ lived a long time ago, but his power is still being projected because it was an inner power, and specifically an inner power. You know, when he was arrested, and here you've got the Romans, you've got the power of the hierarchy in Jerusalem, and they're going to crucify him, and it seems like he's helpless. Is he helpless? He said, I could call down a legion of angels if I wanted to and defeat you all. He could have wiped out the Roman Empire, but he didn't, because it was an inner power, because he was playing an inner drama. If he had done that, it would be an interesting story, but he didn't do that. What he taught were the principles by which we can find our own power. So let me come back, because I was talking about these three lower chakras. We have this system of energy. I won't go into it. Most of you know these teachings quite well. So the chakras have particular energies associated with them. And Master Yogananda taught that we're sustained by a universal force, a universal power called prana. And that prana sustains us on a very intimate, moment-to-moment level, just as the sun sustains all life on earth in an outward way. Prana sustains it on an inner way. And so if that prana comes in, and in our subtle spine, if it descends and goes out, that's what makes us think that we can exert power outside of ourselves, and that exertion of power, control outside of ourselves is going to make us happy. It's really due to the flow of energy. And so that flow of energy coming down and out, when it comes down to the base chakra and it goes out, it produces in the consciousness the thought that possessions and money and control over the things of this world is what is going to make us happy. And so we spend a long, long, long time trying to amass more possessions, more things. I saw a bumper sticker once that said, he who dies with the most toys wins. I saw another bumper sticker apropos to today. If God had wanted us to vote, he would have given us candidates. Davy said she saw somewhere, apparently humorous, but I'm not sure, that according to a poll, 31% of Americans would prefer the earth to be hit by a meteor than to have to vote for either of the presidential candidates. At any rate, without diverting into that, because we could lose ourselves here, as the energy goes out from the base chakra, it produces the desire for things and for matter as a crutch to build around us. But it doesn't work. But the desire for that is one of the base delusions. So as we read, the love of gold is the root of all evil. The love of that is one of the basic things. Evil is the desire to impose your control over others in spite of whether it improves their lives or not, as the Nazis did in France. And so the desire for gold, the desire for sex is the second one, that we think that we will be happy with more relationships, with more sexual energy. Now, I don't know if you've noticed that either of these themes might be current in our advertising or our mass media. And the third is control over other people. And so you have these themes, and you could call those the worldly or outer solution to the question of how to be happy, the outer control, the outer power. And as that energy goes out, it hypnotizes us, it mesmerizes us into thinking that that's where our power should be and our lives should be. So we seek that. But gradually, over a long, long, long period of time, we get enough lotteries or enough positions or enough Porsches, and that bubble, if it doesn't pop, at least it's got holes in it and it can't sustain itself. So gradually, over a long period of time, we don't seek outer power. And so when that energy is going out, we think we can achieve it outwardly. When the energy is being withdrawn and moving up, because the consciousness rises as the energy goes up, in the lowest chakra, where you used to think that I will be really happy the more I have, the more money I have, the more things I have, the bigger house, the bigger cars, all of that, the more of that I have, the happier I will be. As the energy begins to rise, the opposite happens. You begin to think, the less those things aren't making me happy, the less I have of them, I just need a little bit. And so Yogananda came along, he knew these truths, and he taught simple living, not poverty, because poverty pushes it too far, but just simple living. If you can get your consciousness around the fact that you don't need more than what you need, and that it's relatively easy to acquire what you need, you will find much more happiness, much more contentment in that paradigm. And so automatically, as the energy withdraws and moves up, non-attachment happens. And then if somebody is caught in the paradigm of power and wealth and control and comes and tries to tell you that his reality is the real reality, you'll just say to him, can you move a few inches to the right? You're blocking the sun. Now, who has more power? Who has more control in that situation? Obviously, the person who's self-content, the person who has his sexual energy under control, is much more happy in the long run than those who don't, because these lower chakras become addictive. And those who have their own power under control and don't try to project it on others. See, the third chakra is the chakra of fiery self-control, is what Yogananda called it. Now, I had long heard that the evils the three main evils that were talked about in scriptures were wine, sex, and gold. And that if we could overcome those delusions and temptations, we would be happy. Well, I could see how it all fit with the gold the, you know, amassing of things and sex. But I couldn't fit wine into that paradigm. How does wine fit in to this energy of the chakras? But what does wine do to you? If what we're after is what real happiness comes by is fiery self-control, wine removes that self-control. And so it works in the exact opposite. And these three, as the energy goes outward, these lower three energies are very addictive. And so it's hard to overcome this. So as we move the energy up the chakras, this is the center of love and of kindness in an upward direction. It's emotion. I once said the difference in the heart center between the energy descending and the energy ascending is the difference between an Italian opera and an Italian saint. So an Italian opera is the energy descending and all the emotions are all stirred up and somebody's, you know, anyway. And then in the throat, it has to do with calmness and control over the energies, the creative force of the consciousness. At any rate, without going into that, now I want to talk a little bit about some examples that I've seen of people who exert inner power as opposed to outer power. One of my first examples was my father. I had a very interesting, one could say, odd father. He was very, put himself through college, became an architect. He supported his family during the Depression, then put himself through Yale under his own energy supporting his family. He was very quiet, very concentrated, very centered. So I had two brothers and a sister, so there were four of us. And my mother, my father hardly talked at all, but my mother made up for it. So it was a probably, I grew up in Minnesota, so probably conversation was slightly above average, you know, in our household, but it was not evenly divided. It was one half of 1% my father, and the rest was my mother and the kids. So all this chaos would be going on, and my father, we'd be watching television and playing games and shouting, and the dog was there, and you know. And my father would be sitting at the kitchen table doing what he enjoyed, which was reading calculus books and working out calculus while all of this was going on. So enormous concentration in the midst. So I get some of those genes that come in handy for a yogi. But my father also was a man of enormous integrity and just absolutely bedrock integrity. And one time, my mother told me I wasn't there. One time, because he was an architect, he worked with all the builders and contractors and so on in the area. One time a contractor came into the office and accused him of doing something that was incorrect and probably illegal and cheating. And my mother said my father just stood up and looked at him and said, "I have never cheated anyone or told a lie in my entire life. Now get out of here." She said this guy just kind of quaked and ran down the steps, and they never heard from him or had a problem with him again. So I had that example. I had the example of Swami Kriyananda, who is a man of enormous power, the most powerful person that I've ever personally been in contact with. Now, he didn't project his power outward so much because it wasn't like he tried to control other people, is what I'm saying. He did project his power outward, but it was an inner power, and that inner power rallied others around him. When he felt that something was a matter of righteousness, a matter of dharma, he was like an enormous boulder in a little stream. He was absolutely immovable on it. Now, the boulder doesn't reach out and keep slapping the stream. It's just there. And so Swami was like that. In righteousness, he was incredibly firm, and everybody had to move aside or get in alignment with that righteousness. And he pushed a lot of buttons because of that. But nonetheless, that bedrock Dharma was there. Now, how powerful is it that this inner power, when Yogananda was young, he had, of course, enormous power. And they saw in him a kind of leader, and people came to him because there was, even before he left for America, there was this sense of wanting to be rid of the British. And so they wanted to do an armed rebellion against the British, and they wanted him to lead it. And he said, no, that is not my way. He said, in fact, India will be free in our lifetime, and it will be freed by peaceful means. And of course, then some years later, not very much later, Gandhi began his movement that resulted in independence for India in 1948. But you look at the power of Gandhi, and the power of Gandhi was an inner power, because he refused to tell a lie, he refused to be violent, the certain kinds of universal axis of universal law on a spiritual level are things like nonviolence, non-lying, non-stealing, non-sensuality, non-greed. These are the yamas of Patanjali. And Gandhi was absolutely in tune with that. And one of the teachings of yoga is that when you get perfected in one of those inner powers, your control outwardly is complete. So if you're in complete control of the tendency to be violent within yourself, then everything becomes peaceful in your midst. That's the power that gets projected. That's why Master and other yogis are able to tame tigers or be with tigers. And there's a story of Master being with a group of boys, and he goes out into a forest, and the cows haven't been put away properly, and they hear a tiger in the clearing. And at night, so Master goes out, and he takes a little lantern with him, and the wind blows out the lantern, so it's just him in between the cows and the tiger. And he looked at the tiger with so much love and so much power that the tiger just came up and rolled at his feet. He kind of scratched its belly, and then it got up and padded off. And I've read many stories of yogis, high, high yogis, playing with tigers like they're little house cats. And so when you're in control of your inner power, then the world around you begins to respond, but not because you're overtaking that, you're not forcing your will. You're just like an enormous magnet. And, you know, it's like a enormous sun or galaxy. Light has to bend its way around that lens. And when we project our inner power, we become enormously powerful in the expansion of what happens outwardly. I'll end with a story and then an example. I met Swamiji in 1967 in San Francisco, and relatively soon after that, about a year and a half, I became his assistant. And so at that time, all of Ananda existed as his little two-bedroom apartment in the avenues in San Francisco. And so the day that I started to work for him, I came to work, and there was a man visiting him. Some of you will have heard this name if you've been around this path, O'Donnell Lay. He was the center leader in Vancouver that Master praised so highly. Anyway, he was visiting. And so Swami and this other great yogi that I'd heard about, they were there. And I came in fresh, ready to go to work, happy. And Swami at that time had had a series of temporary secretaries. So there was the latest of the series of temporary secretaries there. And so I came in all eager and fresh. I was like, 24 years old. And I said, okay, what are we going to do? We're supposed to get a mailing out because Swami was advertising. Where's the mailing list? I'm not going to show you. You're not going to
make it clear who's saying that.
Oh, I said, where's the mailing list?
To,
and this woman who was very threatened by me coming in said, I'm not going to show you. Do you have index cards with the people that were, I'm not telling you, you know, and this went on. And so after about an hour of this kind of great blockage, Swami and O'Donnell Lay, this is a small apartment, and we were in what would, in a normal apartment, be the dining room, and he was in the kitchen with O'Donnell Lay. And this big argument was going on, and I was feeling incredibly embarrassed by the whole thing. Finally, after about an hour or so, this woman had had enough. She slammed the things down. She says, I quit. I'm leaving. And I was mortified. I mean, here I am, the first day on the job. And within an hour, I've blown up the whole thing. So I was really mortified. And so Swami and O'Donnell Lay, finally, after she slams the door and leaves, Swami comes out and he's chuckling. And he says, thank you. I was wondering how I was going to get rid of her. Because, you know, obviously if she was disharmonious with me, she was just a disharmonious energy. But it was, and that was the beginning of my work experience, my job with Swami. At any rate, it was a very interesting example of the difference between inner power and inner calmness and inner focus, and not necessarily projecting that outward, but the universe then gets in alignment with what needs to happen, or what the energy is flowing through you. And so Yogananda has given us the tools to get in control of, in touch with first, and then in control of the energies that produce our inner power. And when we have the inner power flowing, everything outwardly flows from that. But more importantly, because outer control is really not the object, when we have control over the inner flow of energy, which is what yoga teaches us, then we have the key to how to find lasting happiness and how to avoid suffering. And that key is something that we have been looking for ever since we were back there as an amoeba. And now we have that potential to find that and to express it, until literally the great, great ones who are in control of that find themselves in unity with the consciousness that has created everything. And in unity with that, if they want to, they can create or destroy universes. Now that's power, but it doesn't come outwardly, it comes inwardly. And that inner power is what we're searching for, and the key to our own happiness, and ultimately the key to a society that is peaceful and harmonious and beautiful and uplifted. Because when people realize that their job is to control themselves, not other people, conflict disappears.
Good evening, everyone. I'll share a few thoughts as well. First, I want to say how nice it is to see so many dear old friends that have come this evening. And it's a joy for us to be with you. So when we speak of Yogananda as a guide to our own inner power, as Jyotish has been sharing, I find it fascinating. There's a passage in The New Path. Swami, we always would tease Swami because when he would sometimes give these great lectures, but he would start off with what we would call the cosmic gases. He would start so big and so vast, and then little by little he would bring it down to something that was very personal and very immediate and meaningful to us. But in The New Path, in the chapter, His Last Days, where Swamiji's talking about Master's last days on earth, he uses an analogy which is absolutely fascinating. He says, in undifferentiated space, there are atoms, single atoms, just floating randomly around. And in as much as they can measure them, sometimes there's as much a distance as 17 miles between atoms, and the rest is just void. And then, seemingly randomly, some of these atoms will bump into each other, and their magnetism holds, and it forms a cluster. And as there more are drawn to that, the greater their magnetism, until finally it becomes a huge mass with a huge gravitational field of millions of miles. And when that happens, it begins to implode upon itself and to coalesce, and it becomes a star, and a star is born. And so the analogy that Swami uses is that so it is with our own evolution. As our soul grows, we draw one by one understanding and wisdom and expansion of awareness. And the more we evolve spiritually, the more we magnetically draw those kind of thoughts to ourselves. We draw those insights to ourselves, those patterns of growth to ourselves. And finally, this gains critical mass and a spiritual star is born. And such is the evolution of the life of such a one as Yogananda, or a Christ or a Buddha, starting out just as we are now. But little by little, over time, the power of divine light and wisdom within that draws more and more until it becomes a great spiritual light. And then what happens? And this is where we come in. Because that light is not just in space alone, those great spiritual stars, but it draws to itself other souls that are looking for the truth. And these form, if you will, spiritual galaxies. And these are the disciples of a great master, which come again and again with him over time. And in this chapter, Swami says, he believes, and the more I study history, the more I see this to be true, that these, because Master said he was William the Conqueror and Henry the First was his son, changing the course of Western history. And then again, they dropped these hints. He was, Master was a great king of Spain, Ferdinand el Santo, they called him, Ferdinand the Saint. And his son was Alfonso X, Alfonso il Sabio, the Wise, who wrote, oddly enough, 400 pieces of music, wrote hundreds of books, spoke many languages. Does that sound like someone you know? Swami Kriyananda, if you don't know who I'm referring to. But what Swami says in this chapter, in The New Path, he says, I believe our line of gurus have come again and again throughout history to change and help uplift human consciousness. And they have drawn families with them. And these families incarnate again and again through time. You know, one of my most precious, sweetest memories of Swamiji was once we were visiting him in Assisi, and we were talking about his life as Henry I. And we were talking about who might have been what player in that life. And then people were saying, well, maybe he was this and maybe she was that. And then Swami looked at me and he said, well, who do you think you were, Devi? And I always felt Swami was my father. And I said, well, I don't think I was anybody very important, but I think I was your daughter, one of your daughters. And so I was some obscure princess in that lifetime. And so then we talked more, and then it was time to leave and late in the evening. And we were just going out the door, and we turned to Swami and pranamed. And I said, good night, Swamiji. And he said, good night, princess. And I just treasure that in my heart, because it just awakened like a father to a very cherished daughter. And that's what I felt at times. And so these families of souls come together. And then interestingly enough, so we are such a family of souls that have been drawn by this great star, spiritual light of Master and his great disciple, Swamiji. But then what Swami goes on to say is once they've been established, there are other families that have been, for example, there are a number of congregations of other churches that come regularly to our guest retreat at the Expanding Light. And they don't join Ananda, they don't change their teachings, but what Swami says in this chapter is this family of souls clustered around a great master will draw other families and help them in their particular evolution. And this is what we see happening. And remember when Master's foremost disciple, Rajasi Janakananda, a man of tremendous power, a great yogi from many lifetimes, with 7 years, I believe it was, after receiving Kriya initiation, he went into super consciousness, cosmic consciousness, and remained in that state. Master called him his little one. And once Master said to Rajasi, don't forget where your power comes from. And Rajasi, just like a child, said, I won't, Master, it comes from you. And it was that understanding where the power came from that gave him his power. And that's why, there's a Greek myth of Hercules was given this task to wrestle this undefeatable giant. And the giant was his mother was born of Mother Earth. So as long as his feet were on the earth, he drew that power from the earth and he couldn't be defeated. But Hercules figured this out. And so the way he could defeat him was hold him up in the air long enough so that his power ebbed away. And then he could defeat this dark force. Well, so it is with the power of dictators and conquerors. Their power doesn't come from the true source. And so it inevitably and ineluctably diminishes and runs out. But as long as we are plugged in to the divine source, and that power can't be used outwardly unless God tells us to. That's why Christ said, I could draw a legion of angels and defeat the Roman army, but my task is to do the will of God. So it's rare that those souls that feel that power from God within them use it in a worldly way unless God tells them to. And that's Moses parting the Red Sea and so forth. There's many examples. But when we realize where the source of our power comes from, then it's an unending flow in all circumstances in our life. In whatever goes on, we have access to that. And I remember so many times watching Swamiji in seemingly impossible situations where there didn't seem to be any hope that we were going to find our way out of this challenge. And just with that centeredness, without muss and fuss, never raising his voice, never getting emotional, but just knowing how to use the power of God within him, how he was able to overcome every obstacle that stood before him. And so how do we tune into the power? I mean, it's nice to talk about it, but Yogananda gave us many things that help us tune into that power. First of all, he gave us the techniques of yoga, of meditation. He said that he brought to the West the cream of the cream of the teachings of yoga. The teachings of yoga are complex. They're varied. They're so myriad. But he brought the cream of the cream. And then he also created the energization exercises. There's a wonderful article on the YouTube, one of our young men that was born and grew up at Ananda, Keshava Betts. He's now helping with our center in Los Angeles. He just wrote an article called The Energizer Bunny. And he said, I started doing energization, and I'm not saying we all have to do this, but it's worth reading his experiences. He said, I do them 6 times a day. He said, I don't hardly need to sleep. I don't hardly need to eat. My energy is unlimited. But if you're not doing them once a day, make sure you're doing them once a day. If you're already really under your belt to do them once a day, try it twice a day. But the teachings that they've given us to enhance our energy that Master brought, and of course, energization is, for those of you who have Kriya Yoga initiation, you really need, in your practice of the energization, to go deep enough so that you see how it's the beginning step of the practice of Kriya. The use of control of energy by your own willpower and to direct that energy. It's exactly what we're doing with Kriya, except on an inner level, not with the physical body. But that's why Yogananda knew where he was going with the consciousness of the West. He knew what we needed. There's another fascinating sentence in Autobiography of a Yogi where it's the chapter, Babaji's Interest in the West, and Master says, Babaji knew the complexity of the materialistic consciousness of the West, the complexity of the materialism of the West, and the impact that it would have on India. And so he knew he had, the great masters knew, they had to come to the West. They had to implant spirituality here so that when India began noticing, oh, wow, look at computers. Oh, wow, look at material wealth. I saw a headline that there are, India ranks 13th in the list of billionaires in the world and 130th on the care of the downtrodden. So that great imbalance. And so the Great One sent Yogananda to the West so that we would then have that influence and balance the energy. But so they gave us these tools of meditation and technique to help you to realize your inner power. And I don't think there's a devotee I've ever met who says, you know, I've really got meditation down. I'm so pleased with my practice. I can really go deep every time I sit. I never fall asleep. You know, my mind never wanders. I never think about anything else. This is the roadmap that we've been given, and these same obstacles lay in front of every one of us. But we've been given that's what it says in the Festival of Light. Into our hands have been delivered the sacred keys of awakening. What's he talking about? The tools of yoga and meditation. Those are the sacred keys of awakening. And then, so we've been given these tools. We've also been given community. These families of spiritual, like-minded souls. And these help us to believe in ourselves. Many years ago, Swamiji asked Jyotishin and I to start an ashram in San Francisco, which was called San Francisco House. And there was a young man who lived there with us, and he said, I always felt I had so much, I had something of value to give to the world, but no one ever wanted it until I came to Ananda. And that's the beauty of what these families are. Everyone, and it's what Swami gave to us. You've heard me say this perhaps, but in the early days, Swami would walk into a room and he would say, good morning, all you great souls. And we would look around to see who had come in, because we couldn't surely have been talking to us. But that's how he saw us. And that's how you see today people that are shining lights. And why is that? It's because Swami believed in their own potential, and he gave them the ability to believe in it themselves. And then we all radiate it to each other. We all affirm. And it's one of the greatest joys of my life, and it's, I can feel increasingly it's the role that Master wants Jyotish and me to play, is simply to reflect to other people their own highest self. And it's really all I've ever wanted to do, and it's the most fulfilling thing in the world, just to help people believe in themselves. You can do this. You have the ability. I don't care how many times you've fallen flat on your face, who's counting? Get up and start again. And if we can all do this for each other, this great, we're invincible in that power. Someone, you know, Ananda Village is in a rural area, and someone was asking me a few years ago, what will you do if the world begins entering into chaos and people know you have food storage, they know you have gardens and so forth, and what if people come and try to take this away from you? Will you take will you have guns to protect yourself? And I said, no, that's not where our power lies. Our power lies in community and working cooperatively with others. And what we will do is create a network, and we're starting to, with all the people in the greater area, working together with them on shared political concerns, helping with the volunteer fire department, helping exchanging vegetables and produce from other areas. So our power lies in the cooperation of a broad network of people. And that's an invincible power. And that's where, again, the power of the individual is enhanced by the group, if it's done properly, if it's not done with the sense of competition and I've got to be at the top of the heap. But that's why Christ said, the last shall be first. He who can say, I'm happy to be at the end of the line, then it draws the best out of everyone. And similarly, over the years, we have many different departments at Ananda, and maybe some will be struggling financially and some will be doing well. Well, the ones that are doing well don't just say, oh, well, this is really going well. Then they'll, whatever excess they have, they let it flow to the ones that are struggling. And it's the same thing with people. In a group of people, at any given point, someone in this room right now will just have received word that a loved one has a terminal illness. Someone will just have received word that there's been a financial setback. Someone in this room will just have received word that their child is struggling in one way or another. And similarly, someone in this room will just have received word of a wonderful gain in their life, whatever it might be, some goal they've been achieving. And so there's ups and downs in any group of people. But if we can just balance those out, when we're being strong, then we help those that are weak. I remember a number of years ago when I had just received word that my father had passed away. And I went in, it was early in the morning, and I was living up at the meditation retreat at that time, and I went into the dining room, someone was going to drive me to the airport, And it was in silence, so no breakfast was in silence, so no one was talking. But I went in there, and I just stood there. I didn't say a word to anyone, but the strength, everyone had just come out of meditation, they were eating breakfast in silence. The strength of being in that room sustained me for all that lay ahead, going back and dealing with the loss of a parent and family members and settling all the business involved. But the strength and power we can give each other, this is another gift that Yogananda gave us. But the greatest gift of all, and he, Master, would quote this often, Christ's words from the Bible, to as many as received him, to them gave he the power to become the sons of God. So what does it mean, receive him? Be receptive. Draw that energy. Draw that consciousness. Draw the attunement with that great one. But the power to become the sons of God, what does that mean? The ability to awaken our own higher consciousness through our receptivity to our guru and the great ones. The power to become the sons of God. The son, what does that mean, to become the sons of God? To awaken to who you really are. If you listen to Swami's tapes over the years, he has many reoccurring themes, but there's one sentence that I love. He says, I don't want to convert you to anything but your own highest self. And that's what the power to become the sons of God, your own, the power to be realize completely your own highest potential. And that's why these great ones have come. That's why we've been drawn into their orbit. That's why it's so important, and increasingly in the turbulent times in which we find ourselves, that we exude this power. And it's not going to happen through politics. It's not going to happen through financial manipulation. It's going to be, it only happens through that extraordinary energy that is exuded when one is totally at one with the source of divine power within them. And then we can change the world. It's a challenge that lies before us, but it's the challenge of awakening within us the power that God gave us, and then saying, I know where that power comes from, Master. It comes from you. And the more we can live in that way, the more we fulfill our individual karma. But I deeply believe that Ananda also has a world mission, if you will, in front of us. And that's in these times of turbulence and darkness, to bring the power, the light that is generated from that power into the world. And through many, many different ways. But even if we never said a word, even if all we would do would be to withdraw to the Himalayas and sit in a cave, but with the power of God within us, it would change the world at this time. So it's not just for ourselves that this grace has been given. These great stars have been born at this time. It's part of the story of human evolution that was written long ago. We have our part to play, but we will play it with the greatest effectiveness if we realize that it is God's power that awakens the power within us. So I would like to conclude by inviting you to join me in Yogananda's prayer for world peace and harmony. And I'd like you to close your eyes, sit up straight. And this prayer, if you don't know it, we repeat in unison, Lord, fill this world with peace and harmony, peace and harmony. We do that 10 times, and then we repeat, Lord, fill me with peace and harmony, peace and harmony three times. But the more we can be joined in our sincere desire to see peace on this world, the more power we can generate, more God-given power we can generate to affect change in this world. So let's repeat in unison. Lord, fill this world with peace and harmony, peace and harmony. Lord, fill this world with peace and harmony, peace and harmony. Lord, fill this world with peace and harmony, peace and harmony. Lord, fill this world with peace and harmony, peace and harmony. Lord, fill this world with peace and harmony, peace and harmony. Lord, fill this world with peace and harmony, peace and harmony. Lord, fill this world with peace and harmony, peace and harmony. Lord, fill this world with peace and harmony, peace and harmony. Lord, fill this world with peace and harmony, peace and harmony. Lord, fill this world with peace and harmony, peace and harmony. And now, Lord, fill me with peace and harmony, peace and harmony. Lord, fill me with peace and harmony, peace and harmony. Lord, fill me with peace and harmony, peace and harmony.
Life that all strife reconciles.